Paul, you say that this is about as black and white as it could be. And personally, I agree. Stay with the airplane. But I want to separate out how much of that is always stay with the airplane and how much of that is the fact that this crash happened at the end of the day and it's going to get dark soon. So let's run the Wayback Machine here and say that this crash happened at 10 o'clock in the morning. So you got all day. Everything else is the same. Two people doused in gasoline. One of them hit their head. Nobody seriously injured. Plane is a wreck. No cell service. Would that change your choice and how?
Yeah, it would. Because if it happened at 9 in the morning or 10 or even noon, you've got 5 or 6 or 8 hours of daylight, that hike to the top of the ridge to get cell service becomes more tenable. And it would probably be a reasonable risk, even in that kind of terrain, with a dense overstory, to hike up there and count on the cell service. So yeah, I would definitely consider that. I would also consider it under any circumstance if somebody was seriously injured and with whatever medical capability I had, I determined them to be expectant, then I would go for the climb and try to get cell service. Otherwise, no one's injured. Going to be a pretty miserable night, but you just complicate the SAR case if you start wandering around from the wreck.
Staying with you for a second, Paul, if I understand you correctly, you would consider to, or would almost certainly try to, that is, go up to try and get a better cell signal. But 3 and 4, actually trying to hike out and get to a person, those are still off the table. Is that correct? Too much risk?
Yeah, too much risk and too much time. And I think that the probability, then the percentage of getting the cell signal at the top of that hill is probably pretty good because it's within visual sight of that ski area. So that is the shortest, quickest way to summon some kind of assistance. If you go crashing through the woods, I mean, we're talking about a several mile hike here. I mean, the shortest is 4 miles through steep terrain in woods. Man, if you've ever done that, you're a quarter of a mile into it. It's no trivial problem. It can be very challenging. Plus, you don't have a compass and you don't have a topo map. So you can get full up lost out there and then you've made it worse.
Now, Catherine, you are definitely going to try to get the cell signal, although afterwards you're going to make it back. I want to pursue just the logistics of that a little bit. You have 45 minutes till sunset. And you're in tall, deep forest here. Not far from civilization, but it's already dim. Walk me through that. Why is that worth the risk?
Right. So I figure we have 45 minutes before sunset. And after sunset, you may have another, say, 20, 30 minutes of decent ambient light. So I figure I have 1 hour. And I'm going to walk uphill as 30 minutes will allow me to find cell service. And if I cannot do that, I'm going to turn, regardless, even if I get cell service and make a connection with somebody, I'm going to turn back around and get back to the wreckage before it's dark.
Wally.
I reviewed this scenario with a friend of mine who has lots of years of CAP search and rescue activity. And he agrees 100% with Paul that if you start that long walk, if you start that walk up the hill, as Catherine's suggesting, that works. I mean, that's great if it works. But now you're coming back from that walk and it's getting dark and it's pretty easy to get lost in that dense woods, unless you have at least a compass or a topo map. So as Paul said, if someone leaves the scene of the accident, now they have two searches to do instead of one. So I'm inclined to stick with choice one.
Yeah, and I have to say, I would too. I feel like the person who's going to try and be the hero here is actually going to be the one who gets found last. This setup, it's kind of different for the scenarios we do. The emergency, as kind of happened already, and this pilot handled it pretty well. But obviously, we don't want this kind of emergency to happen. So I want to back up a little bit into some of the things Paul said. Sightseeing is something we all do. We like to do with our friends. Like you said, Paul, this was not an unreasonable flight to take. But let's look at just the route planning for sightseeing. You know, we're all trying to balance the altitude for safety versus altitude for the best view. What are the kinds of things you could do to make this work better? Kevin, you, I know, have flown around the Northeast. It's not the mountains of the Pacific Northwest, but, you know, over some pretty wooded terrain, shall we say, even up in my neck of the woods. How do you balance that being high enough, safe enough when you're taking people out for a sightseeing flight?
I don't know that there's really any hard and fast answer on that one. I think the biggest thing is just making sure that you're dressed for stepping out of the airplane at any point along your route, which is the spot that these people have found themselves in.
Wally.
If you're planning on crossing a ridge, you shouldn't even start that process until you can see clearly over the other side of the ridge. This pilot was hoping to climb his way over that, but I've approached a lot of ridges in gliders, and you don't get much climb in a glider. So if you can't see very clearly across that ridge and see the terrain on the other side, you're not going to make it. And then you have to think about which way the wind is blowing, because it may very well produce a big bunch of sink as you approach that ridge.
Paul.
Yeah, just reinforcing what Wally said, this pilot, according to the route we plotted, did what he should have. He followed the drainage, so he's got some options there. But when crossing the ridge, you really can't plan to do it at 100 feet with a relatively heavily loaded airplane. So I don't know what the magic number is, but it's not 100 feet. So that means you climb in the drainage, or you climb over the low terrain, and then make your turn across it at the sharpest angle that you practically can. So you're exposed to the high terrain for the shortest period. And then you're back into the next segment of drainage or lower terrain. And if you do that, you're just minimizing the effects of a downdraft or turbulence or an engine failure or whatever hazard you might encounter. And that just has to be second nature.
Picking up on something you said, Kevin, these people in the plane, they didn't have the clothing for the terrain they might step out into, you were saying. But they were dressed for the daytime. I think it's pretty clear in this, they're going to be there overnight, probably no matter what. They might be found one or in the morning or something like that. How much do you plan for not just the terrain you'd step out into, but like how long you might be there? Essentially, another way to word it, what is reasonable to carry in the airplane for a local flight or a cross-country flight in the day in hospitable terrain?
It's a tough one. I mean, I did say that I'd prefer to dress for having to step out of the airplane anywhere en route, but I live in New Hampshire. We've got the White Mountains here, and I certainly fly over them in the wintertime. But I'm not going to sit here and say that I bring snowshoes and crampons and that sort of thing with me in the airplane for flying over the whites. It's just not what I do, and I suspect it's not what most people do. For me, it's more just to be able to just stand outside or maybe do a short walk. I think that's a reasonable compromise in bringing something appropriate for the weather versus necessarily having intentions of hiking out.
John.
In my airplane, I have a pretty good survival kit, which I leave in all the time. It's a duffel bag, probably 15 pounds or so, and it's got space blankets, fire starter, food, dried food, bunch of stuff. But until we started looking at this scenario, it's probably been 2 years since I opened the bag and actually looked inside to see if there's any expiration dates on this stuff. The batteries that are in the emergency lights, all that stuff. So if you have it, you need to maintain it. The other thing that got me thinking in this is that I stuff it in the back corner of my baggage compartment and then pile all the suitcases and luggage on top of it. And it actually should be the last thing to go in, so it's closest to the door or hatch or whatever it is, so you can grab and run if you have to. So if nothing else, this is going to change the way I load the aircraft and maintain that survival kit.
Yeah, Paul, you mentioned the PLB, a terrific tool, or an in-reach spot communicator. You said have it in your person or stow it in the airplane. Can you count on stuff that's in the airplane? I mean, this plane had the fuel come pouring in. It very well could have caught fire, which would have been a great signaling device, but it would have ruined anything that was in the airplane for long-term survival. So is that a reasonable thing to have it just nearby in the airplane, or do you need to have that kind of stuff on your person?
It's reasonable if you look at the preponderance of the data. So one of the accident sweeps I just did, only 5% of the accidents were unsurvivable. So that's a pretty low percentage. So that means that they didn't burn, they weren't completely destroyed, the airframe was in some kind of reasonable condition. So you will increase the likelihood of it being useful if you have it on your person, like a survival vest or something like that. I don't do that in airplanes. When I've had airplanes of this category, like John, I had a full survival kit back there, and it weighed about 15 or 20 pounds. And it had just the stuff that he mentioned, plus tools, plus passive signaling devices like a mirror. At the time, we did not have PLBs, but if I were re-equipping that now, I would have a PLB, and definitely a VHF handheld. And now with the advent of really powerful, cheap LED flashlights, at least a couple of those in the airplane. I mean, now if you're going to go up through the woods, even at dusk, wouldn't it be great if you had a flashlight? I mean, that can make the difference between go and no-go to me. People routinely just don't think about these kinds of things until they're in the circumstance where they desperately need them. And a scenario like this does a service in reminding people that this could happen to you in a heartbeat. You could find yourself crashed in woods 5 miles from civilization and not be able to get out of it because you didn't have first aid, or you didn't have signaling, or you didn't have any means other than a cell phone, which may or may not be useful.
Well, wasn't there that accident, I believe it was in Florida, where people crashed and they could hear the highway and they died of exposure? They couldn't get there and nobody found them in time, if I have mm-hmm. that right. Wally.
A cheap and light protection is large size trash bags. You can make a little suit out of a trash bag pretty quickly if you need to, and that's going to hold a lot of heat in, and the rain will run off also.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of space blankets. They weigh almost nothing, and they can be used for all sorts of things, including signaling, because they are so reflective, which is really nice too. This might be my coastal prejudice and living in the woods so much, but Elaine, I think of Wisconsin as being just kind of open and flat. I know that may not be really legit, but is this something you think about when you're crossing open terrain, or is it you're pretty confident with so many fields, you'll be able to put it down in a field and walk out to somebody somewhere?
That's a great question. So much of Wisconsin is actually very heavily wooded, particularly in the northern half of it. So anytime you're going to take even a medium-sized cross-country north of, say, Madison, Wisconsin, which is kind of in the southern third, you're leaving a lot of open fields and small forests to more heavily wooded areas. So it is something we do think about around here. I do have a survival kit and a four-seater that I fly, and if I were to take a longer cross-country to a more remote area in the tailwheel aircraft, which is usually used for local flying, we'll consider a small pack there as well. So it's always situational in terms of what you would carry with you, but it's something you think about. And the other thing I've learned from just flying around Wisconsin, which is also very agricultural, especially in the southern part, having seen crashes happen in the open fields, open plains, it can be really darn hard to spot an aircraft that has crashed into a cornfield or into a small patch of woods. So we learned that even then, any kind of survival tools or signaling devices can be handy regardless.
Staying with you for a second, Elaine, but anyone else can chime in on this. Do any of you let people know as a regular habit or practice where you're going and when you expect to be back? I mean, I know in Canada, flying around there in the past, you're required to either file a VFR flight plan if you're, I think it's 25 miles beyond the airport of departure, or a flight notification, leave information with a, quote, reliable person, unquote, as to where you're going. And it's baked into the regulations unless that's changed. Is that something you do, Elaine? And anyone else can chime in on that, too.
I would say I probably enough for a local flight because it's not the kind of thing you think of, although you think, okay, by default, somebody knows you're at the airport and flying, but not necessarily when you're due back. So maybe we can do a better job in thinking that through every time. For cross country, I generally tend to think of it because I believe these days that the cell phone or the text to a friend has replaced things like flight service, flight plans, opening and closing. So I think most of us do have some kind of a backup there, but that's generally how I've addressed it. Longer flights or more remote flights, yes. Local flights, not so much.
You're nodding there, Catherine. You have some forest down there. I don't think about it as being like, really sure. Inhospitable terrain, but you'd disappear into a forest in Tennessee pretty easily. Is this something you think about and how? How do you?
Absolutely. Well, when I travel away from Sewanee, I typically file. But I'll admit this scenario has gotten me thinking about my local flights. And I'd like to say that I've been better than I have been about, you know, letting my family know exactly when I am flying, say, on a local flight. So I think, do that more in the future.
Kevin.
For me, it's more of a practical consideration and the just juggling the different things with the wife and kids and school and picking up from daycare and dropping off and both of us working and all the things that happen in life, we share a Google Calendar. And we mostly that's just to coordinate with what we have going on. But also, if either of us, and she's a pilot also, but if either of us are flying, then we'll put the flight on that calendar, origin and destination. So we might not necessarily stress about the exact routing or super precise details like that, but just origin and destination, and then being able to look up online the ADS-B data to see how either of us are progressing with a flight, that works pretty well for that purpose.
I'm wondering if anybody uses VFR flight plans anymore. I know in the past, people around this table, I know in the past, you know, the VFR flight plan was kind of like the thing you did when you were lonely, so flight service would call you at the end of the day to remind you that you forgot to close your flight plan and make sure you were okay. But it has become easier to file these and open and close them with tools like 4Flight. Has that shifted it for anybody? Wally?
A couple of years ago, I took my Moody to California and I filed IFR until I got into the higher terrain where I no longer was able to maintain MEAs the way I wanted to go. So on each leg of that flight, I filed a VFR flight plan because I wanted somebody to come look for me if I had a problem. And I also use flight following, but I was doubtful that I could get radar contact in all those places. So I wanted to have something as a backup besides flight following.
Yeah. And did you update your position with flight service through a long flight with your VFR flight plan as you went along or just open it and close it?
I opened it and talked to them whenever I made a little progress. Yeah. I was trying to leave some rabbit tracks out there for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned VFR flight following. I know up here in Maine, we had a situation several years ago. It was with a float plane, but they were on flight following. They didn't have a flight plan. And they saw the lake that they were heading for. They told the controller, we have the lake in sight. Flight following was terminated. The plane crashed, and they were found the next year. So it's a good point to bring up that flight following isn't necessarily just a substitute for a VFR flight plan. Paul.
Yeah, and we should point out that neither is IFR because they're several circumstances where crashes have happened. Airplane was still on an active IFR flight plan, and the SAR case didn't get going for hours. And I think I know of one that was at least overnight. So it's a much higher percentage with an IFR flight plan, but it's certainly not bulletproof.
So everyone but Paul on this one, how much faith did you have in your nice, shiny 406 ELT going off and notifying people before you heard how many actually fail in the crashes? Catherine's like shaking her head, so I want to hear.
Actually, I was surprised at the lack of reliability with the newer ELTs. So that's another thing I'm from this scenario.
Kevin.
For us in our airplane, we have the GPS-equipped 406 ELT, which I absolutely think is well worth the investment. But the other thing that we have is the switch to activated sits just above the throttle on the panel. And I don't see any reason why I wouldn't activate it prior to hitting the trees if I think I'm going in. So to that end, I think I would have some pretty good confidence that it would function as intended as long as I'm hitting the switch and I am activating it manually as I'm going down or I'm about to go in or whatever terrible thing is happening. If we're just strictly relying on the G sensor or switch or whatever it is to go off from the impact, then yeah, I have a whole lot less confidence.
You know, that's a great point. I think a lot of pilots don't even think about that remote panel for their ELTs. And a lot of times they're mounted underneath the circuit breakers behind the seat by a fuel selector or something, like they're trying to get it out of the way, you know, off the panel. And it should be like right up where you can see it, both that the alert's going off for a false or that you can push the button. And one thing I've heard is that a lot of the failures are actually due to severed antennas when the ELT, in just the impact forces, kicks itself free from its antenna. So it's going off, but there's no message. Catherine.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best takeaways from this scenario is the idea of activating it before the crash.
That's why we called it after the crash, so that you remembered it before the crash. John.
To Kevin's point about activating it beforehand, that would be a good thing to let a non-pilot passenger who flies with you regularly, and I've shown my wife how to do that, where the ELT switch is, and you know, if you hit your head on the panel, she could always hit the arm button, or not the arm button, but the on button, make sure it activates.
Paul.
So it's part of our briefing.
Your point about the failure point being the antenna is spot on. And one of the dirty little secrets about 406s is that when the technology was introduced, they didn't really do much to change the mounting method or the hardware or the location of the antenna. So they're just as vulnerable as they ever were. And if you happen to have an accident, you get out of the airplane, it is a good idea to see where the ELT is and see if it's still connected with its coaxial cable to the antenna. If it is, it's a pretty good chance that it went off, and that if it has a manual switch, you can engage it. And of course, I mentioned the data on the 406 with GPS. I mean, the difference in search time is astonishing. And if you're going to crash, the best place to do it is in Alaska, because in Alaska, the Coast Guard does the inland searches, and they have just a phenomenal time to rescue. It's just absolutely amazing. One of the accidents I found, they were on site in about 7 minutes. They happened to have a dolphin in the area and got right to it. So definitely, as Kevin said, the GPS, if you're going to do the 406, definitely get the GPS. And if not, then get a PLB, because the time on PLBs is good too.
I wasn't sure going into this scenario what we would be talking about, but what I'm finding here is there's not so much things that are new in the scenario, but things we've gotten maybe complacent about in our own flying. Like, how old is that bag with the survival gear in it? And wow, have I really updated the gear I carry with me? And, you know, a PLB or a spot navigator, they're small, they're inexpensive, relatively speaking. All of those things help you be prepared for the thing that you never want to happen. And this pilot did the right thing in a couple critical ways. They flew the airplane into the trees, number one, rather than letting it stall and spin in. So the pilot did the things necessary to survive the crash. But survival past that point isn't about the walk. Survival above that point is about the wait, having the stuff you need in order to be there when the people find you. And you don't want to try to be the hero, because that's someone else's job, and they are much better at it than you are.